Well, hello, everyone. And I am having a little bit of an issue with the technology here. I've moved to a different internet connection, and it looked as though a show that was supposed to air for you has not been uploaded as I thought that it had. So here I am on the air, and it looks like this is going out to you. And I'm hoping in just a few moments the show uploads for you, so that you can hear what actually was there for you that we had prepared. In the meanwhile, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what has been happening in this last week. This is what we call totally winging. I have moved to the east side of Harlem, and I'm enjoying this new neighborhood. I'm learning about an area that actually has quite a history. When I walk around, I see different sites where a lot of people who were essential in the Harlem Renaissance lived and worked and created their art. So it was quite a move to do. It's taken me about a week to finish everything. But I am happily almost all the way moved in. I'm borrowing somebody's internet connection at the moment and hope that by Tuesday I will have my own internet connection and will be back to normal. So I'm on Facebook with a good friend of mine and a regular listener in Lynn, and I'm hoping that he calls in for a moment. He told me that he had something to say, and I know Ian has something to say. He might be talking about Maha, which is a musical and acting extravaganza that goes on. I'm not sure if that's what he's going to talk with me about or if it's going to be something else, but I'm going to wait for him to call in a few moments. In the meanwhile, I'm going to tell you a bit about what you might be hearing a little bit later on. The guest we were to have for today is Chris Purnell, and I'm going to ask her to come in September, because she's going to be talking in September about running for public office. One of the things that I really want to promote here on the show is people getting involved in their own communities and making their own communities better, people getting involved in making their own economic situations better, not just in terms of finding so for being in control, being in a situation where you're not dependent on other people's decisions so much for your well-being, but where you can be independent. And, you know, this nation was built up of people who were pioneers, people who were self-starters. There is a deep history and value for that thing here in the United States. And so that is what I focus get into, and that's what I'm hoping to do here with the show. So Chris will be talking later on in September about what it was like to run for public office, the things that she learned in the process, and things that you should learn about going into public office. You know, it can be a controversial thing. A lot of people come into public office with high hopes. Their campaigns are, of course, filled with promises for change, promises for remembering the people who voted for them and remembering the needs and the issues and the causes that inspired them for office. And then I think what happens is that they get into the legislature, or they get into whatever governmental body it is that they were running for, and they discover the truth of the matter is that consensus is not so pretty, and that in a democracy it does require people to work together. So, you know, we don't have a benevolent dictatorship in spite of what some people might think, but we do have a democracy. There are people who would argue with that as to whether we have a democracy. But once you get into the business, actually, of governing, folks find that it is not as easy to forward the goals and the promises and the causes that inspired them when they get in. So that is something that we might talk about as well. What happens to people when they get into public office? What are the real challenges that they face? And I'm looking to have somebody come on the show who is either currently a member of a governmental body, who's an elected member of a governmental body, or perhaps more realistically, it might be somebody who's a former member, former senator, or former congressperson, who can talk about the realities of what happens once you actually get into the public office. Why is it that we find that people seem to change? What are the pressures that they actually face? What are the things that they find themselves forced to fight in order to get anything done in public office? So Chris Purnell will come with us a bit about her experiences running for public office. And then I have Angela coming onto the show in a couple of weeks, next week actually, and we will be talking about the value of a college education. There are articles that I've read that question whether a college education is still worth it. You find students going deeply into debt, with the economy being what it is and some of the decisions that have been made in Congress in the last few weeks in order to settle the debt ceiling crisis. There were concessions were made that had to do with kinds of public aid that are available to people. And I heard that Pell Grants, for example, were under, I don't want to say that they were under attack, but they were in jeopardy. And Pell Grants are some of the ways in which people are able to get money in order to go to college. And if you're not assured a job after college that would allow you to at least pay off those loans, much less live, then is it really worth it for you to go to college? So we're going to talk a little bit. I've got Ian apparently trying to call me right now. I don't know if he's listening to the show. If you're listening, Ian, I need you to call the show rather than my phone number. The number to call is 818-532-9789. And, in fact, I'm going to keep the number open for anybody who wants to call in. This show is happening on the fly, as it were. So if you have something that you'd like to chat with me about, the only thing I ask is that you respect certain parameters, and that includes watching your language. That's something that I talk with all of my guests about, to make sure that we honor the fact that this show is available to anyone to listen. And I promised my sister in the very beginning when I started airing the show that I would be conscious about those things. She encourages her kids, my nieces, to listen, and they're both below the age of 9. So I am very aware of that kind of thing, and I do ask that you honor the language and the subject matter, making sure that it is available to children as well, or suitable for children as well. So I'm going to give the number again. It is 818. It is 532-9789. 818-532-9789. And hopefully I'm going to hear from Ian in just a moment, and he will get his chance to have his moment on the show. Ian has been a longtime supporter of the show since the beginning of the show. He helped me out a few months ago when I had a guest become ill and was unable to make the show, and he helped me to put together a show. And so I know that he would be eager to call in and talk about that. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit about that show, because we're going to be continuing on that topic. The show was called Police in the Church, and it was talking about how there is a program in Brooklyn here in New York, here in the United States. For those of you who are listening overseas, Brooklyn is one of the 5 boroughs of the city of New York, and there are a couple of churches that work together with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office, and that's the prosecutor's office, to help people who have what are called C summonses. So these are tickets that involve quality of life crimes, if you will, littering or walking your dog without a leash, or public urination, or perhaps having an open container of alcohol. All of these are C summons level violations, if you will. And what happens with these violations is that ordinarily you decide to plead guilty or not guilty, and if you plead guilty, then you pay a fine, and that's the way that it is. Some people don't pay attention to the tickets, or maybe they lose the ticket, they miss their court date, and if you miss your court date, then it becomes a different issue. What happens then is that you're now subject to the court's ire, because the court is not happy about being ignored, and so the court may issue a warrant for your arrest. And when I heard about this, the scenario that came to my mind was, oh, okay, so maybe I head out in my car one day to pick up milk at the corner store, and as I'm driving back to my home, I notice the police lights come on behind me, and I think, well, what did I do? Did I run a red light or miss a stop sign, or perhaps my taillight is out? These are some of the reasons why people might get pulled over. And I get pulled over, and I find out that perhaps I did miss the light, or I ran a stop sign. And in the process of checking out my car based on that violation, the police ran my driver's license or ran my license plate and discovered that there is a warrant out for my arrest. And so here it is. I was just taking a little trip to the store to pick up a bottle of milk, and now I end up actually in jail, because what they'll do is that they put you under arrest, and your car gets towed to an impound. You're put under arrest, and you have to go to jail. Now, woe betide you if this should happen on a Friday in the afternoon or in the evening, or if it should happen on a weekend where there's a holiday on Monday and they don't have court during the week, because it means that you may end up spending 72 hours or more in jail over a fee summons violation. And so what happens is that people who get these violations and perhaps understand that there might be a warrant out for their arrest, they hide. They often hide or live lives in great fear of what might happen to them. Well, this program was set up by the district attorney's office in conjunction with the churches, and it allows safe, in a sense, for people to come in and see the judge without being under fear of being arrested for the C summons. And before they go before the judge, they actually meet with volunteers who are trained, and there are volunteers there who are also lawyers who will look at their records and make sure that all they have outstanding are these fee summonses so that they can go before the judge. And, of course, the judge cannot guarantee, nobody can guarantee an outcome for anybody who shows up, but they are guaranteed. All right, so it looks like I'm being reconnected. Okay, so it looks like I'm reconnected. Ladies and gentlemen, as I said, I've moved to a new place with a new internet connection, and so I'm learning new things about this connection, and it looks like I got kicked off the air with the connection that I had. I certainly hope to be able to work out the kinks on this week, and so that next week we can have a show that runs quite smoothly. That's why this show was only scheduled for 30 minutes. In a sense, it's a test, and we're going to see how things go from here on out. So what I had been talking about before getting unceremoniously kicked off the air was that we were talking about this couple of churches in Brooklyn that have partnered with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office to help people who have C summonses come in and have those C summonses taken care of. And these are people who have tickets who perhaps didn't, and they're not moving violations, but for other things like having open containers of alcohol and or for public urination or spitting or something like that. But they ignored the ticket for one reason or another and now had a warrant out for their arrest. So there's going to be another one of these programs in November coming up this year, and I'm hoping to arrange for the folks at the church and the district attorney's office to be able to air the show live from the church during the process, and it's 2 days, I think it is, that they will have judges available at the church for folks to come and volunteer lawyers available for folks to meet with before going before the judge. And so I hope to go at least on one day and air the show live from there so that we can talk with the people who are involved. We can talk with the volunteers. Perhaps we can talk with some of the judges or somebody from the district attorney's office. And then perhaps we can talk with people who benefited from the program, who can tell us about why they decided to go ahead and come in at, and how the program has been has impacted them. And from what I hear in reports from this last time that they had the program, I think it was back in April, it was a roaring success. There are people who walked miles. There's a young woman who I estimate she walked about 20 miles, actually, to, or maybe it was 15, something like that. It was an extraordinary amount of walking that she had to do in order to get from where she lived to the church in Brooklyn in order to get this summons taken care of. There was another woman whose son had become very ill in the meanwhile and was not able to come in himself, but she came in on his behalf, and they kindly were able to help her take care of his summons. And, of course, the issue there, it was really touching and heartrending in a way, was that he didn't want to pass away with this on his record. So it is a major project. It is something that is really important to a lot of people, and it's helpful to a lot of people. So that's something that we're going to do in the future. There's also another show coming up on the 21st of this month. I will be interviewing a playwright, Mr. Charles, who has written a play called Growing Up Daddy, and it's a one-man show. I saw it a couple of weeks ago and was so taken by it, so impressed by it, that I decided to go ahead and invite him to be on the show. On our Father's Day show, we talked a bit about fatherhood, and those of you who listen to the show regularly know that I'm a mediator. I'm a couples and divorce mediator, but I also work with families, and I work with parents who have never married and who have broken up but need to form a new parenting relationship in order to raise the children that they share in common. So the show itself is about a single father who is on the eve of his child's birth facing a dilemma about whether he should stick around and what would it mean for him to leave, and talking about what it was like to grow up himself as the child of separated parents and what it meant for him not to live with his father but to see his father on a sort of part-time basis. You know, his father had visitation. And so it is a show about himself. It's semi-autobiographical. And it is a show about being raised as a child who does not live with his father, and also about himself now wondering what would happen if I were to leave this child, and what is going to happen since I'm not going to be married to this child's mother, what kind of a father am I going to be? So that's the 21st. And then on the last show of the month, which I believe is on the 28th of August, I'm inviting Pankaj Amin back to the show. Pankaj Amin is an expert in private equity investing. He specifically works with companies that are small to medium-sized companies that are in the midst of a turnaround. So he can go into a company that may be struggling and help them to find ways to increase their revenues, to increase efficiency in management, and so forth. He spent quite a bit of time studying the economy before he purchased his own business and ran it for about 7 years and then sold it. And so he has a lot of interesting and innovative ideas about the future of the economy and about what you should do in order to be able to adjust to it. We know that we had a huge drop in the stock market in the past week. It has sent shockwaves around the economies of the world. We are certainly in a very different time at this point, and there's a lot of uncertainty for a lot of people. So what we aim to do is to be able to give you tools that you can use to address the new economy, to address the times that we are living in now, so that you can live through them. We're not even interested in people surviving. We don't want you to survive, but rather we want you to thrive. We want you to know that it is possible for you to thrive even in this economy. So we're going to be talking about that. All right, I'm going to take a moment and play a bit of music for you. You may have heard before, but I am playing this artist because he is so near and dear to my heart. His name is Bonga Ziwe Mabanga. He is from South Africa. The album is called Umlilo, and the song is the title track to the album. It's called Umlilo Wazizatu. So we're going to hear that piece, and I'll be back with you in just a moment. Kind of winging it. So I have my friend Ian Lynn who called in, and I see that I've lost him for a second, so I'm going to ask him to call back in. And he has with him Jeffrey Davis, who is a person of, who should be interesting to everyone. There's a peace walk that he participated in, Ian participated in, and Jeffrey Davis, Mr. Davis, will be on with him to explain what that is all about. And I'm showing that I have about 2 minutes and 30 seconds left of the show, but we may continue streaming after that. So I'm asking you to bear with me. This is a roller coaster ride. We are trying this new technology, and I think it's really exciting. So let's see what happens. All right, Ian, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Beth Valley.
Hi, Ian, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Could we see if Mr. Davis is there as well? Can we hear him?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. This is so wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm very honored. And I hear from Ian that he participated in a peace walk yesterday, and this is something that I know about. Could you tell us, Mr. Davis, what that is about?
Sure, sure. It's the 18th annual Love Yourself, Stop the Violence Peace Walk. It originated from my beloved brother, Councilman James E. Davis. Unfortunately, he was assassinated inside New York City Hall.
Yes,
July 23, 2003.
Yes.
So after the Crown Heights riots, we formed a Love Yourself, Stop the Violence Peace Walk and different projects to bring the community together here in Brooklyn, New York. After the Crown Heights riots, we had a beautiful child, Gavin Cato, and a young man, Yanko Rosenbaum, was killed. Gavin Cato was killed through a car accident, and Yanko Rosenbaum was killed as a result of it. So we've been traveling around since then, since the city, now the country, after the assassination of my brother, spreading the word of peace through film, through art exhibits, through peace walks in the street, through a peace breakfast, through multiple avenues to spread the word, to pretty much save lives.
So,
yep.
Yes, I can hear you. These are unfortunate and tragic incidents that I remember hearing about, and I do remember hearing that in your brother's memory, you have continued the work of promoting peace and promoting peace within the communities, especially across communities. Tell me a bit more about how the work has been going for you. And I have to say, I commend you so much for keeping your brother's memory alive and being so passionate about this particular issue.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it. It's been 8 years, since my brother made the transition. But we started this together, 10 years prior to that. So it's a total of 18 years. It's been going well, extremely well, since my brother's transition. I met thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and I like to use the slogan that we don't die, we multiply. Brothers and sisters came out the woodworks for the peace movement, and the effort has increased. Just yesterday, we did a peace breakfast where we filled up Applebee's restaurant inside Restoration Plaza in Brooklyn, here in Brooklyn. Applebee's is one of our sponsors. They came aboard, and we break bread together. I like to say that preachers, politicians, and the people, we all came together and we broke bread to have a good time, to reflect and keep the dream alive. So just last year, we did a wonderful, wonderful art exhibit. Each year we do a photographic art exhibit downtown Brooklyn in the Fort Greene area, displaying the work that we do continuously throughout the year. Last year we highlighted Ian's work. He's a wonderful photographer.
I remember that, yes.
You seen it?
Unfortunately, I was not able to make it out to see the show, but I've been able to see a lot of Ian's work on Facebook. So I do know what you what you mean.
Yeah. Ian is a tremendous photographer, photographer with superstar potential. This year,
certainly,
in December, leading to next year, we're going to exhibit the work that we did yesterday and again throughout the remainder of the year. And that's another form of reaching a different community. So we're in the street reaching, showing the people that we're one, with our flags hanging high and our chests out, saying that, crying out, love yourself, stop the violence. And then there's an art community that likes photography. to like the artwork. So with Ian's great work and the exhibit, and we have the building downtown, Brooklyn, the Art Center, we're going to be doing exhibiting that. And also we show film. We have a wonderful, wonderful documentary where we reach film a film audience who loves going to film. And we show our historic film called Murder at City Hall, Councilman James E. Davis' story. So we're reaching different groups through the art because we're artists slash activists.
Yeah.
And it's working. And it's working. We're in the schools. We're in the churches. We're in the streets. We're in the art studios. We're in the movie theaters. And it's working. So it's really, really working. And we have a wonderful GED program, too. So it's really working, and it's tremendous.
But it sounds like you're putting together three really powerful elements, many powerful elements, but I've heard three of them in just a few sentences that you just said. The arts, music, education, you know, bringing all of those together to aid in this effort. I have a question for you, and you sort of alluded to the answer, but I'd like to be more specific about it. And that is about the question why. Why this community violence that happens? And you talked about the power of breaking bread together and people coming together. So I wonder if you could address a bit what you have discovered in the last 8 or so years of doing this work about the underlying, the root causes for some of the violence that we see in these communities.
Sure. Well, our community has been through a lot. I mean, dating back to the 1800s, dating back from racism, dating back from single parenthood, poor education, poor housing, particularly the African-American community, we've experienced so much. So this is we need healing. We need a lot of healing going on because we've been through a lot. So because of the lack of actually loving ourselves, we hurt our brother, we hurt our sister, because which is actually ourselves. So because we don't love ourselves, we lash out at ourselves, our brother or our sister. So when in turn we hurt somebody else, we're actually hurting ourselves. That's an image that we see of ourselves. And we need healing. My view is that we need healing as a people. We need God. We need healing. We need understanding of ourselves as a people. So including myself, in the last 8 years, this has been therapy for me without my brother. Healing. I mean, just yesterday, I became emotional when we reached a certain point, which is Eastern Parkway and Notion Avenue. The sign is up of my brother, James E. Davis Avenue. It's right there on Notion Avenue. And I get emotional because it's been 8 years, but it's still healing and it's therapy with the people coming together. So with domestic violence, we sit in a chair, a group of 10 or 15 people down at Kingsbrook Church Medical Center, and we just express ourselves from grandmothers all the way down to husbands and wives because we need healing, and that way we won't react as an emotional people and lash out at other people, which is actually lashing out at ourselves.
Right, yes. But it is so important not to try to suppress the things that happen and suppress the pain, the experiences of violence and racism and, economic violence and so forth, but to talk them through. And, you know, what I find when people talk about these issues in a group, then the ideas can start flowing for how to heal, for resources, for programs and so forth. So talk to me a bit about, you'd mentioned some of the things that have happened, but tell me a little bit more about the programs and activities and successes that have come in the past 8 years.
Through our GED program alone, this one is huge. Through our GED program alone, we've helped students, you know, these are grown people, we've helped students with, let's say, 8th grade educations reach the level of 11th grade, education, where they were able to take the GED test and pass it. And then seeing them go to MedGavis College and going to college, and graduate from college is I dropped out of high school in the 9th grade. My daughter was born. I was a teenage father. I was 17 years old. 18 years old. My daughter was born. So I left school myself to go work, thinking that's the right way to take care of my daughter.
Right.
And then in turn, I went back to school and got my GED. So when I got my GED, Then I went on to an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and I see that. So when I see a student actually thinking that it's over educational-wise, mm-hmm. and then they get their GED, and then I see them walking in the halls of colleges, mm-hmm. or when they come back and helping teach, tutor other students, I say that is emotional because that's something I went through. So
just this past summer,
speaking at a high school graduation, knowing that I didn't graduate from high school, and now as time went on, because I got my GED, and they're calling me back to speak at a high school graduation, you can turn things around in your life and you can keep going. And through therapy, I was able to do that, and I think through healing, and the community can do that as well, because it's never over and it's not too late. And God is a forgiving God, and he's, and you can continue, you can get back on the horse,
yes.
and you can make it in your life.
Absolutely. What a message of hope that is, and what an inspiration your story is, that even as a teenage father, you did what most people do in that situation. You quit school and went to work so that you could support your child. But it is important to understand that there are resources available so that folks can finish their educations and continue because, ironically, we're talking about this now. My guest next week, I believe it is coming in to talk about the value of a college education. And so, the statistics do tell us that people who graduate from college make, quite a better living and have better economic success. Generally speaking, and so, college education has been, at least until this point, very, very important. So it is important that folks are understanding that it's not over, that you can go ahead and continue and get your college education and experience the economic benefits that come from that. There's something else that you mentioned as well. You were talking about healing and about how you were emotional going down Eastern Parkway, even though it's been 8 years since your brother was shot and killed, and that you still deeply feel that loss. But you're out there helping other people, and I think it's important that folks get an opportunity to hear from you the kind of healing you can receive from helping other people. So talk with me a little bit about that, how helping others can heal in and of itself.
It's therapy. It's therapy. Seeing somebody, because every other household, we know a family member, a cousin, a friend who was killed through gun violence, through domestic violence, through economic violence, emotional, verbal abuse. So we all understand that. And to help someone else and seeing them regroup their life, and actually putting their fist up in the air and doing photography or putting their dream, making their dream alive again, it's healing for me because I get a chance to continue the message of hope, continue the message of peace, continue what I actually truly believe that I was put here to do. When you find your destiny, this is something that you, when you find your destiny, who are you? What's your DNA? What are you made of? What is your, who are you? What are you on this earth to do? Who are you? And when I, and it's my destiny. It started 19 years ago. I was put here. I ran into the tragedy hit home. Even before, after we were in the streets saying love yourself, stop the violence, and telling people you can make it. And then the tragedy hit my doorstep. I had an either I can say, all right, everything that I've been preaching to the community, now that it is home, how am I going to respond? So now that the community is looking at me, saying, okay, now it hits your doorstep. Because it can hit anyone's doorstep. No one is immune. And then it hits my doorstep. I said, okay, there's thousands of people looking at me. You know, the TV cameras were there, the radio, the magazines. And I said, the people are looking at me. Folks can be inspired by me just continuing and not just being a, doing it a year later just because of the emotions. But once it reached the 8th year, the 9th year, the 10th year, people can realize if I can make it, you can make it, we can make it through together. That's been the healing for me. The pain as a victim of a family member dying never goes away.
Right. Yes.
My brother was 17 months older than me. We lived together our entire lives. Our apartments, when we reached adulthood, was right next door to each other in the same place. His apartment, his apartment was B. We were together our entire lives. So him being 17 months older than me were like almost twins from children. you know, as my mother raised us together and father raised us together. So the healing part, it never, ever goes away. Sometimes now at 3 o'clock in the morning psychologically, I'm thinking hopefully it's a nightmare, listening for his voice, waiting for him to walk to the door. But spiritually, I connected with Reverend Dr. Johnny Ray Youngblood, and we connect with a lot of things spiritually, and I realize that he's still here, not in the flesh, but in the spirit,
yes,
as is the Holy Ghost, and we make it through together as one.
But, you know, it's a deep thing to hear from you that 8 years later, you know, you're still waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning hoping to wake up and find it a nightmare, that it is still that palpable, that strong. If you feel comfortable doing so, could you tell us a little bit about your brother and what led up to the tragic end of his life?
Oh, my brother was huge. He was huge. For me, personally, he was my hero and my brother, my friend. But we started the Love Yourself, Stop the Violence walk with just him and I and maybe two other people. Then it reached, we reached close to 10,000 people marching down Nostrand Avenue, crying out, Love Yourself, Stop the Violence. It gathered people like Amanda Holyfield, the boxer, and Don King, the boxing promoter, and Spike Lee, the film director, and Salt and Pepper, the hip-hop artist, and Corporate America got involved, Toys R Us, Nike. So it started reaching a wide range of people. Wealthy people to blue-collar folks were able to touch and join hands. And then you had Muslims. My brother was a minister. He was a reverend. So you had Muslims reaching out to him. You had Christians. And then you had the Jewish community also reached out to him. So he started getting into traveling to Israel, to Trinidad, to Africa, and using that model in Crown Heights, which is a very diverse community, to say that if it can work here, then it can work everywhere and all over. And then he decided to get into politics. And we thought together maybe the political road, because at that particular time there was a lot, and even today, there was a lot of corrupt politicians who were generating millions through discretionary money. And the community, the CBOs, community-based organizations that were actually doing the work, were having a difficult time of receiving the resources. The ones that were grinding, reaching the community in the housing developments, reaching the community but not receiving the resources that they were able to receive. And the ones who were not actually reaching the community were generating $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 a year. And they weren't actually doing the work where the executive director was getting, if they get $500,000 a year salary, $500,000 a year budget, the executive director was getting half of that, $250,000 as a salary. That was $250,000 gone from the community.
Wow.
What executive director was getting?
No, I'm just saying, wow. I mean, it's astonishing what you're saying.
Yes. So we decided to get into politics where the money from City Hall, from government, can actually reach the community. So then we said, all right, let's start running for office. So we ran for the assembly, came up a little short, ran for city council, came up a short, and then ultimately my brother won the city council seat and through the backing of the community. So when he won the city council seat, there's a machine in politics, they call it the machine, where the unions are against you when you're running, the politicians against you, the Black Association is against you, but we rose up and the people were with us and we won the city council seat. So there was a gap there from the elected officials because somebody who represents the people, hardcore, that weren't being represented, was in the middle of things now. Where he was in the middle of it, whereas the people supported him. So then the next step was for running for mayor and or Congress, and now the community started benefiting. There's an arena that they're building downtown called Barclays Arena, where the New Jersey Nets are coming to Brooklyn. They're going to be called the Brooklyn Nets. They had to sit down with my brother, these major billionaires, had to sit down with my brother as a city councilman and hash out things on whether he can approve it for them coming. So his main thing was, I'm Brooklyn's progressive, but Black folk, if you will, and Latino folk have to have jobs. We got to work in there. The community has to work in there first and foremost. It's progressive, but you can't bring people from way out of nowhere to come work when we have the qualifications and the talents right here. So when these developers started coming, he made arrangements for the community to work there first. There's an organization called BUILD, Brooklyn United for Local Development. He organized that. He organized community benefit agreements for if the developer comes, then you have to put aside, let's say, $20 million that's going to benefit the community if you come into this district. So he started working out deals like that, which is modeled after a lot of people do it now, community benefit agreements. And then he started working with the police because he was a police officer prior to winning the city council seat. And he was a police officer, spoke out against police brutality. So when he won the city council seat, because he had inroads in the police department and he was respected, then he started really addressing police brutality and for the police to respect the community. So he was able to address that. And because of the popularity with the entertainers in the past, he was able to address that, MTV, and the Toys R Us, and different things like that. So inroads was making, and then unfortunately, God is good, unfortunately, he was shot and killed in City Hall. He was assassinated in City Hall. And that was his story, and he made the transition. But the legacy lives. 8 years later, we're still marching down the street. People who didn't know James E. Davis are crying out, "Love yourself, stop the violence." It's working. People who didn't know the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey in the 1920s are carrying red, black, and green flags. So it works. We don't die. We multiply.
Well, you see, what you've proven then is that even those who try to stand in the way of hope and progress, ultimately, by killing, the spokespeople, ultimately find that they forward the message in a sense because that inspires and galvanizes people to get involved and to move the word forward and the work forward. It is. Ironic and terribly sad, of course, that the very evil that your brother and your family and everyone who's been working in this cause, but when he was alive, he was such a spokesperson against violence, and for him to be taken in that way is sad and ironic. But again, as you have mentioned, it has given folks something to work with, to say, look, we can avoid these tragedies from happening again. And so it is a marvelous thing that you have remained so passionate in making sure that your brother's legacy not only remains alive, but grows. Tell me a bit about the future. What do you have in mind for how to continue with the legacy and the work that you're doing?
All right, sure. Through film, we reach millions of people through film. So with the documentary, we want that to expand to film. Through the arts, through art exhibits, you reach countless, hundreds of thousands of people. So through the artwork that we do each year, we want that to grow, and we want to go on tour with the artwork of the peace movement so we can reach tons of thousands of people. Through the peace walk, we want that to continue. We have sponsors. I want other people. Now, when I walk down, when I cry out, "Love yourself, stop the violence," I usually have the bullhorn. But so what I gradually do now is I pass the bullhorn to others, and they have the bullhorn so that they can get the message, and then they can create a movement within them, within their own organization, and then I can begin to. I'm 27 years young. As I get older, I can go to their peace walks, or as I retire, the peace walks can continue throughout the different communities. We want to go to New Jersey, we want to go to Philadelphia, and I want to structure and organize. I want to structure and organize and coordinate other great leaders in different states, and simultaneously we do the peace walk at the same exact time in different inner city communities throughout the country. I want the president and the Congress to identify and realize that this is a crisis in inner city communities, that our young people are killing each other randomly, and I want them to identify that and put that on a priority list to deal with the issues of blacks and Latinos killing one another constantly, and dealing with that, we have to deal with that, and it's not just... And as a psychological thing, it's a mental thing, and I want that to be put in the forefront so that we can address that and the economics and the social issues that take place in inner city communities. So we're looking to do through film, through art, through music, through peace walk, through education, a wide range of things, and it's coming along nicely. In 2 years, the Barclays Arena will be finished right downtown Brooklyn in the heart of Fort Greene, Prospect Heights area where my brother was a councilman. I want to have the 10th annual memorial for him, the memorial service in that arena that generates 15,000 people, and I want us to do it live on TV so the world can see that we don't die, we multiply. Love yourself, stop the violence. I want to get maybe Stevie Wonder or a major headliner. I want my pastor, Reverend Youngblood, to do the word. I want to do the memorial for all victims of violence so that we can fellowship and we can remember our loved ones and we can heal together. This is the direction I want to go.
I am so excited and inspired by what I'm hearing from you. I will look forward to attending this marvelous extravaganza that I hear you planning. You know, I'm one of those people who says, just do it, as the Nike slogan says. And when you dream it and you speak it, you absolutely can do it. So I know that this 10th anniversary celebration extravaganza that you are dreaming of will happen, and it sounds as though you have the support of so many people. It's really important to hear that you are interested in growing leaders within the organization and outside as well. How exciting for you it will be to go to other people's peace walks and be able to see how the work that your brother started and the work that you are continuing has grown, so that it's not just about you being there in the forefront, but that it has grown. As you said, we do not die, we multiply. So seeing that come to life is going to be so important, so exciting for me. I am so impressed by what you're doing for our communities and the issues that you're bringing forward. Again, it is an unfortunate violence in our communities, is an unfortunate reality that continues, but it's not inevitable. And can get better, do we? I want to thank you so much for joining me, especially since it was sort of impromptu. This radio broadcast has been a little bit unusual from the broadcast that I usually do. I usually have things really nicely planned out. I had some technical issues, but decided to go ahead and try to broadcast a show today anyway. And you've come on and made it absolutely worth it. I'm so glad for you being here and for Ian bringing you on the show as well. Any last thoughts that you'd like to share, or Ian as well, if you're still there, any last thoughts you'd like to share?
He forgot. Let me just add one thing. He forgot to add a brother named Ian Lynn, who's going to photo document that whole event when it happens at Barclays Stadium.
Yes, we must not forget
Ian,
brother.
Ian is a role model. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can hear you.
Ian is a role model. I tell him all the time, he is a tremendous father, raising the future of our generations. He's a dynamic father. He's a role model. He's a man of God. He's a husband, and he's a community man. He has the whole package, and Ian is an artist. And we're going to put his work in the forefront because it can reach millions of people. Ian is a dynamic. He's a legend, and he's a role model to me personally, and I appreciate his friendship, and I thank God for Ian.
Hey, brother, that ain't going to get you out of this babysitting gig I'm trying to get you to do.
Well,
Can you hear me?
I'm sure he did, and if he didn't, he can listen to the tape. You know, the show is going to be available on demand so that folks can hear the whole thing. But thank you both so much for being on. It's always a pleasure, Ian, to work with guests that you suggest for me and to speak with you as well on the show. And I am so wonderfully blessed, Mr. Davis, that you took some time to talk with me and to share the message. And I will be sure to be forwarding this so that as many people can hear it as possible. I'd like to invite you to come again at a future show where we can actually dedicate the show to you and to the cause, and to advertise it nicely so that folks know that it's going to happen and can be prepared to sit and listen to it. Would you come back again?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, definitely. And I appreciate the invitation. Thank you. Yes.
You're very welcome. All right. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to the show. I am grateful for every single person who listens, and I hope that the show has not been too discombobulating for you. We have experienced a number of unusual experiences, if you will, but we will be back on track next week. I'm going to leave you with a tune that you have heard before, but I think that it is fitting for us to end with this. This is Joshua Fitt, the Battle of Jericho, and it is from the Exposed Blues Duo, whom you've heard here on the show. So it is their take on Joshua Fitt, the Battle of Jericho. And it is a reminder that we must fight on, that we must stand on, keep on standing up for peace, for prosperity, for love, and for the well-being of our communities. Until next week, everybody, have a wonderful week.
Jericho, 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 Jericho,
Joshua Fitt, the battle.